Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm filling in for Al Cresta today. When St. Thomas Aquinas addressed what at least back then and today by means of reason we recognize to be some of the best arguments for the reality of God, and he addressed it by countering some of the best arguments against God in his masterwork, the Summa Theologiae, he listed only two. The first was the problem of evil. How can a God who is perfectly good exist alongside a world that is clearly in suffering and in pain? His second is, God really needed to explain the world? We address these objections and more with Pat Flynn. Pat is the author of The Best Argument for God, which is his newest book. He's a writer, philosopher, podcaster, and speaker living in Wisconsin with his wife, five children, and a St. Bernard. He hosts Philosophy for the People and The Pat Flynn Show, and his website is chroniclesofstrength.com. Pat, how are you doing?
Marcus, it's great to be back with you. Happy to be here. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you. And it really is a joy to talk to you. I must say, so I read your book cover to cover, and it is a systematically brilliant book, a very beautiful synthesis of the presentation for rational arguments for the reality of God. So I don't even have to ask why you wanted to pen this. Instead, what I'm going to ask is, this is an ambitious task. You took on a lot of philosophers, engaging them in either supporting some of their argumentation or going up against some of their contradictions. So in light of that, again, ambitious as it was, you did this really well. In light of that, why is it necessary for us to be able to engage contemporary philosophers in this dialogue?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the compliment, Marcus. That's extremely gracious, and it certainly means a lot. There was a huge amount of effort that went into the book.
Oh, I could tell.
Yeah, and not just me. I had some wonderful editors and just some really great assistance from people that were close to me on many of the areas related to the book, so Definitely a team effort. And your question was, why is it relevant to engage contemporary philosophers? Well, I guess it's relevant because the debate, whether people realize it or not, is alive and well. Mm-hmm. The God debate is really a very fiery and contentious debate within the realm of philosophy of religion. Now, philosophy of religion is sort of a misleading description of a certain academic discipline, because sometimes people hear that and they think, well, is that just a bunch of religious people doing philosophy? And that's not right at all. Philosophy of religion is really where there's many different philosophers, some of whom are religious or believe in God, some of whom are atheist, and, you know, quite a number are agnostic, are really trying to evaluate worldview systems. And a worldview is really just a sort of, you know, philosophical big picture of everything. And, you know, for me, that's always been one of the, if not the most interesting areas of philosophy, because it's really sort of the closest thing in our contemporary age to perennial philosophy, where philosophy really was meant to be systematic, where we were trying to search out, you know, the deepest causes and reasons for the existence of things, trying to develop a grand theory of everything from a philosophical perspective. So it's actually an exciting time, I think, to be alive, because not only is the God debate alive and well, but I think we're seeing some really great work from so many contemporary, you know, religious and especially Catholic philosophers these days. And, you know, I was eager to get in there and try and advance the conversation, you know, in certain areas. And, you know, the book is now starting to get a good amount of attention, so we'll see where it goes.
Well, you've done an excellent job here. And so I want to press in a little further, because as you mentioned, and perhaps one of the great misnomers when it comes to thinking about the Christian faith is that epistemologically we seem to think, as long as we have some kind of a worldview that's you know, kind of remotely Christian, that's sufficient. But the fact of the matter is we're called to have a system, a worldview system, and it's precisely the development of a cohesive, coherent system of thought that formulates a sound, concrete worldview. So as you mentioned earlier, that's really what the philosophy of religion is. So just talk about how crucial it is to develop an epistemological system this way, and how does one go about doing that to begin with?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something that a lot of people probably haven't taken time to consider, but I think it's absolutely worth discussing and worth considering. So unfortunately, a lot of modern philosophy is extremely hyper-specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Many modern philosophers are not engaged or interested in building an entire philosophical system. And a philosophical system is all about, well, answering the question of how does everything hang together?
Right.
How does my theory of ethics, my meta-ethical theory, the theory of, you know, what the good is,
mm-hmm.
how does that connect to my theory of knowledge? You mentioned epistemology. Epistemology is a study of the theory of knowledge. How does that relate to my metaphysics, which is a study of being? How do these things sort of hang together within a coherent system? And how does one aspect of that system influence or inform another aspect of that system? That's a wonderful question. Unfortunately, many philosophers are not really too curious about that these
right.
days. You know, sometimes they just kind of find one obscure question and they kind of hyper specialize for their entire careers to try and answer that question without asking, well, how does this connect to everything
right,
else
right.
I believe? And sometimes they leave that question entirely unanswered. Now, specialization has its place. You know, it's important. That's how we make advances on really tough issues that are deep in the weeds of things. But it also has a cost where a lot of philosophy and indeed a lot of science can really sort of become disconnected. It can seem almost entirely unrelated to,
right.
to other domains or areas of knowledge or life. So one thing, Marcus, I'm starting to answer your question finally, that always attracted me to sort of perennial philosophy and Thomism in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomism is really just that broad school philosophy that follows in the footsteps of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, St. Thomas Aquinas was himself a great systematic synthesizer. You know,
right.
he was bringing together different lines of thoughts from previous systematic philosophers in the Aristotelian tradition and the Neoplatonic tradition and trying to, you know, build his own system to kind of answer some very deep and important questions that were still, you know, active in his day. What attracted me to that, Marcus, was that it was actually a system
right.
in a way that so many modern philosophical schools were not systems. Aquinas tried to have sort of an articulated vision of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's what philosophy is all about. Philosophy is making that critically reflective turn back on experience, trying to illumine our experience, search out its necessary conditions and causes, and set it in relation to some vision of the whole. So to me, if you're not doing that systematic work, you're not really doing philosophy, and that's
right.
what all philosophy is about. So philosophy, yes, it requires specialization, but to me, an expert philosopher is also an expert generalist, if that makes sense. That's where the most interesting stuff is, I think. Did I answer your question? Sorry, it's a big one. It's a tough one.
It was a big one, and I kind of gave you a blank slate there and asked you to draw the picture, because even as our listeners are paying attention to what you're saying, the fact of the matter is this work of formulating a cohesive system of thought that your mind can constantly go back to as a kind of referential framework for how you think about everything. That's a work that everyone ought to engage in, from the lowest of us to the highest of us. It doesn't require a PhD. It doesn't require a master. It doesn't even require going to college or anything. But it's crucial that our intellects are engaged, our reasons are engaged in a systematic manner. And there was a point of time where this was presupposed. You take a look at the Aristotelian framework, and even the work that you wrote in The Best Argument for God, there's a kind of presupposition here that anyone can do this if we just engage our reason well enough.
Yes, I believe that. And there's a reason that Aristotle spent, you know, time doing ethics before he went into political philosophy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's you know, I think to your point here. Unfortunately, in today's society, a lot of people just sort of specialize in political philosophy without, you know, anything to sort of inform
right,
or ground
right.
from an ethical perspective the political positions that they take. But of course, if you start asking sort of certain ethical questions, you're very quickly going to have to, I think, if you're going to get answers to those questions, ask questions about, say, human nature, which is philosophical
mm-hmm.
anthropology. If ethics is the study of the good life, well, then we have to ask, good for what? Presumably
yep.
good for human beings. Well, then we have to ask, well, what is a human being, right? So
mm-hmm.
this just shows how, if you're really doing philosophy, you can't stay in one area.
Right.
Not for very long, because everything is connected and everything matters. So I think if you're going to get the best answers, if you're going to do philosophy well, you have to be willing to build a system, just like you said, Marcus, right?
Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to, again, give you another blank slate, and we only have just a little over 3 minutes here. But one of the first ways in which we start doing this is by, and you do this in your book too, is by acknowledging what the first principles of especially logic are and learning to apply that to how we view everything. So just walk us through what a first principle is, and if we don't cover all the laws of logic now, we'll do it after the break.
Yeah, so people can, I would recommend everybody at least takes, you know, one course and just sort of, you know, an introductory to logic, so you can learn principles like the principle of contradiction or the law of excluded middle or whatever. But even more broadly than that, a principle really is that from which something flows, right? It's really a sort of starting point. So we have certain principles of reasoning. You mentioned, you know, laws of logic, and logic itself is really the study of the structure of thought. You know, most people don't really think about it, but thought itself is something that can be studied, that
That's
has a sort of structure, right? And so why do we study logic? Well, we study logic to understand that structure and to make sure that we're reasoning in clear and consistent channels. So the study of logic helps us to, well, hopefully think better, right? That's the whole purpose of I think, studying logic. It's not so you can just kind of call people out, you know, randomly on social media for committing a sort of material fallacy here and there or something like that, you know, give you a sense of power. But no, really for yourself, right? Because you want to think well for yourself. Other principles of reason would be something like the principle of sufficient reason, which I discuss in my book, and that's a principle of explanation, but it's related to cause and effect, that for whatever exists, there is some adequate reason, some adequate explanation for why that something exists and has the various features or characteristics or attributes that it does. So getting clear on first principles is important. A lot of people agree on a lot of these first principles, but, you know, philosophers have this really awesome ability to disagree on just about everything. So often you, like, for example, the principle of sufficient reason seems, you introduce it to any person on the street and they'll be like, oh yeah, that's about as obvious as it can get. Is that what you philosophers are doing? Boring, right? Is what they'll say. But then you realize that there's actually a whole host of philosophers that take issue with that principle. So then you have to, before you can get your arguments up and running for God, you kind of have to go down all the way to the basement and defend a lot of these first principles, which you would never think you would have to do until you actually kind of get into these philosophical debates. But the important thing relevant to the existence of God is I will argue that if you will just grant a few basic principles, the principle of sufficient reason, and I think also the principle of contradiction, which is less controversial, but there are philosophers that will quibble about that as well, that you can run some really powerful arguments for the existence of God along with some other fairly common sense commitments. So these things might seem a little bit, you know, irrelevant at first, but they're really not, because a lot of the traditional arguments for God are called metaphysical demonstrations.
Right.
And what a metaphysical demonstration is, it's where we can join some very common fact of experience, like the fact that things change or that some things are contingent.
Right.
And then we use a principle, like the principle of sufficient reason, in a line of reasoning that will actually ultimately get us to theistic conclusion, some sort of position that affirms the existence of God.
Right.
Just to kind of tease.
So, Pat, we're going to continue on the other side of the break. I'm talking to Pat Flynn, author of The Best Argument for God. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm filling in for Al Cresta. I'm talking to Pat Flynn, author of The Best Argument for God, perhaps one of the clearest works available right now on systematically presenting not only rational inquiry into why God is and why believing in God is rational, but also in an engagement of contemporary and ancient philosophers, so that, you know, we get a synthesized view, a truly holistic view of why our faith is truly reasonable. Of course, this is only an engagement into the concept of, quote unquote, the God of the philosophers. So, Pat, I want to pick up where we left off there. We've barely scratched the surface. We were doing the philosophy of your book long before we started talking about the content of your book. So I really want to start talking about the content proper. You launch into a lot of principles, but you get into Aquinas's five proofs later. Let's start with, you pretty much open up with Anselm's ontological proof, and you contrast that with etiological proof. So big words, let's pass through what they mean.
Yeah, so why don't I just back up even a little bit further and present the general thesis of the book, because that'll help us explore some of the specific arguments
you're
mentioning here. And because sometimes people hear, hey, the best argument for God, that must just be like one argument, right? Mm-hmm. Like Aquinas' third way or something like that. And look, I'm a big fan of Aquinas, and I have a lot to say that sort of that bears a family resemblance to his style of cosmological argument. But really, my book is really trying to do a sort of judo move on what I think is one of the more serious considerations for naturalism. And naturalism is really just sort of your philosophically developed form of atheism.
Mm-hmm.
And that argument is really something like this. It says, hey, if two theories are explained just as much, then believe the simpler theory. But guess what? You know, atheism and theism, they explain just as much. Only atheism is simpler, so believe atheism. So that would be the atheistic argument. It's actually an argument that Aquinas himself considers, a version of it anyway. So it's sort of an ancient argument, but it gets a lot of attention in contemporary times. And the whole sort of thesis of my book is to reverse that argument and say, well, here's the right way to think about it. If two theories explain just as much, excuse me, then belief is simpler. Okay, I'm fine with that. I don't have too much of an issue with that statement. However, atheism can only explain some, but not all, of what theism can.
Right.
But only when strapped with far greater complexity. So believe theism. And then what that lets me do, Marcus, is it really allows me to kind of line up a whole range of explanatory targets, stuff that a worldview, a philosophical system, which we've been talking about, needs to give a good explanation of. Stuff like contingent existence. Why does anything exist? It doesn't have to exist. We need a story for that. Or human consciousness, or our rationality, the power of rationality. We need a story about these things. The moral dimension, the fact that the universe is stable and orderly, and it's even fine-tuned, as many modern physicists are telling us, right? And indeed, suffering and evil. That is a broad-scale feature of the world that we should be able to tell some story about as well. So really, my book is a cumulative case where I'm arguing it, you know, at each of those explanatory targets. Either theism has the only possible explanation, naturalism isn't even really in the running for giving an adequate explanation.
That's right.
Or in some cases where naturalism has some sort of explanation, it's a very contrived explanation. It requires strapping their theory with a whole bunch of additional ad hoc components.
Right.
And ultimately to the point of making it completely unbelievable. So sorry, I just wanted to back up and set the stage a little bit more, and you'll have to remind me of what your question was.
Oh, sure. Even before that, since we're talking about setting up the stage, let's build that stage a little bigger. One of the problems that you immediately talk about, and you eventually engage it later in the book, is that naturalism by itself has certain nihilistic components. It becomes its own limitation. And therefore, it can't even be in the running for a cohesive epistemological system of thought.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, many naturalists will immediately protest if you suggest that, and this is where we sort of have to wind the tape and look at systems again. And one of the first things somebody should ask is, well, why would somebody be a naturalist in the first place, right? And this is a really interesting question to ask. I think it's an important one. And generally, you get a story like this, Marcus: science rocks. Right? That's the sort of story you get. Now, that's the kindergarten version of it, but really what is supposed to be motivating naturalism is an epistemology, a theory of knowledge that is broadly scientific.
That's right.
Now, scientific means we're talking about scientism.
Yep.
Now, scientism isn't science. Scientism is a theory of knowledge which says, hey, anything that we can know, or really the only things that we can know or be confident about, are the things that come through the scientific method, the hypothetico-deductive method, right?
Yep.
And really, that's going to tell us that the only things that we know that exist are really the things that, like, the hard sciences tell us about, really, like physics, maybe chemistry, something like that, right?
Right.
And the idea is this is supposed to be able to explain everything. We can science it all. And if we can science it all, then we don't need to look towards any sort of supernatural explanation, because whatever else science is about, it's supposed to be investigating sort of the system of natural causes,
right?
The finite physical system. You mentioned etiology earlier. Mm-hmm. Now, etiology is really discussing how one physical event sort of unfolds or relates to another physical event, right? So it's etiological in nature. And if that's right, then apparently we can explain everything just sort of within the system of nature, and then we don't need supernature, right?
Right.
So that I think is the primary motivation for naturalism. Now, somebody might give a different motivation, like maybe they don't think God exists because of the problem of evil. But generally what you'll find among a lot of professional philosophers is they just think that God is an unnecessary explanatory entity, if that makes sense.
Right.
All right. And now, go ahead, Mark.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to – you point this out too, that it's problematic to take on an empiricist etiological perspective when even in that, you take a look at, say, quantum mechanics, right? It's this constant attempt to seek a unifying theory of the whole. So you're attempting an ontology. You're attempting an ontological framework while saying, well, there is no ontology. And so in the process, the very science that you claim to be doing and attempt to do is clamoring for a kind of ontological worldview.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think there's a host of internal issues with naturalism, and I could gladly, throw punches at it all day. But what I'm trying to motivate right now is the sort of the primary motivation for naturalism. So that way, when we draw out what I think its natural, if not inevitable, implications are, one of the responses from the naturalist will be to say, well, hold on, wait, I can add this other thing to my theory to make sense of that and avoid nihilism. But then what we should say is, well, now that makes the primary motivation for your theory completely useless,
right?
And here's what I mean by that, right? So naturalism, say, is supposed to kind of explain everything through some sort of combinatorial mode of explanation, some sort of combination of atomic and evolutionary theory, right? That's the general idea. Okay. All right, great. Well, now when we get to a certain explanatory target, think of the moral dimension or moral experience. Most of us, I think, are intuitively moral realists. Am I that? Most of us believe in sort of moral facts and moral obligations that are more than just mere opinion or sentiment. Like, we think some things are really wrong and we ought not to do them. And we think that people can make wrong moral judgments and they can be held accountable for the moral actions and be really blameworthy and culpable, right? This is the sort of intuitive common sense view. It's pretty much the foundation for, you know, criminal justice and all that sort of stuff, right? Now, however, most naturalists who are consistent, I believe, are nihilists. And you brought up the idea of nihilism before. And nihilism is just a denial that there's any sort of objective moral value or obligation. This is kind of following Hume, that morality is mere sentiment, right?
That's right.
that's all it is. Now, I think that's exactly what you should say if you are a naturalist. Why? Because it seems like the best explanation for our moral experience is that evolutionary or Darwinian pressures sort of shape our beliefs in such a way that they were just useful for survival.
Right.
And so we have these moral beliefs not because they map onto any true facts about human nature and what causes us to ultimately flourish, but just because they were useful for survival, and that is it, right? So if you're a naturalist, your framework, your epistemological and ontological framework, your method of explanation should cause you to adapt or endorse nihilism. That is the natural, if not inevitable, course of action for the naturalist if you are actually starting from, I think, the principled naturalistic starting point. But of course, many naturalists hate that implication, as everybody should hate it, right?
Right.
And nihilism is just almost self-evidently false, right? There are some brave naturalists out there, old and new, you know, going back to Nietzsche up to contemporary philosophers like Alex Rosenberg, who see these implications and they just try to embrace them as best as they can. And for that, I say, great, you're trying to be consistent, but I think it's still insane at the end of the day. And what you should do is you should revise your starting point rather than just, you know, bite the nihilistic bullet.
I'd love to now, go ahead.
Yeah, no, just one final point. So naturalists who want to avoid these implications start to make their ontology really spooky. They want to start to sort of make appeals to Platonic entities, a realm of forms, or like strong emergence. There's lots of weird stuff in the literature that I don't expect, you know, the average listener to understand. But the point is, they start positing this stuff to avoid nihilism, but then this is not stuff that fits within the naturalistic system. It doesn't fit within the inner logic of naturalism. It's contrived, it's ad hoc, and it ultimately, Marcus, this is the point I make in my book, is it just replaces one explanatory problem with another. And in fact, it replaces one explanatory problem with a worse problem, right? And it undermines the primary motivations for naturalism.
Right.
So those are the kind of moves that I think a theist should be aware of, and that really a naturalist sometimes isn't even aware of, because many of them are not really totally systematic, right?
Sometimes
a lot of naturalists are just focused on certain issues in ethics. They're not even, you know, totally aware of the wider history of what's motivating naturalism and what their wider commitments are. So, like, it doesn't really matter to them how spooky they make their worldview. They just think that they can make it as spooky as they want and still call it naturalism. And I'm saying, no, I'm calling foul on that, right?
Right. And like I said, I'd love to go down that rabbit hole of, you know, Nietzsche and being so committed to his brand of nihilism that, you know, led to his own mental ruin. But let's take a step back there, because on the one hand, you've got this whole issue of naturalism as its own nihilism, as its own self-defeating premise. But on the and you've got scientism, you've got this kind of rationalistic worldview as a part of that, empiricistic worldview as a part of that. But then when you take another step back, right, you realize that true organic philosophies, the Aristotelian framework, the Thomistic framework, they don't negate the natural, they don't negate the empirical. If anything, because they are so organic, because they are truly ontological at their highest, right, natural theology means metaphysics, it is capable of not only assuming to itself scientific discovery, it gives us greater explanations for the meaning behind those discoveries.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up, because sometimes people will misunderstand what I'm saying when I'm attacking naturalism or scientism. I'm not attacking science.
Mm-hmm.
I'm attacking a theory of knowledge that is utterly reductive and, I think, you know, just obviously false, right?
Right.
There's a big difference between saying, hey, science is powerful versus science is exhaustive.
Right.
I believe science is powerful. I don't think it's exhaustive.
Amen. Now, Pat, we're going to continue again and finish off this conversation in the third segment. I'm talking to Pat Flynn, author of The Best Argument for God. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. Marcus Peter here, filling in for Al Cresta. I'm talking to Pat Flynn, author of The Best Argument for God, writer, philosopher, podcaster, and speaker, living in Wisconsin with his bride, five children, and his St. Bernard. So, Pat, you know, whenever you and I get to talking, we have very little time to talk about quite a lot. And we've barely scratched the surface of the brilliance of your arguments in the book. But like we were talking about earlier, just before the break, all of this is not to repudiate the scientific method. It's not a complete denigration of empirical systems. It is that by itself, an empiricist worldview, a naturalistic worldview, it is not only reductionistic, it's also nihilistic. So talk about how sound philosophy, like the Thomistic framework, actually allows for an empirical investigation and analysis.
Yeah, well, I think there's lots of reasons to think that naturalism is actually in tension with a lot of the sort of fundamentals of scientific investigation, right? Whereas a theistic worldview is just a sort of worldview where you would expect science not only to emerge, but be extremely fruitful. So let me just highlight a few things. First, I'll reiterate again that nothing of what I said before, nothing I say in the book is meant to, you know, downgrade the awesome power and success of the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about contemporary scientific theory can be incorporated into the Thomistic worldview system.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, I don't think a whole lot in terms of, you know, contemporary scientific discoveries has, you know, all that much to say concerning the existence of God. I guess I'm somewhat of an anomaly or maverick there, because more theists are now kind of, you know, getting very excited a lot about contemporary science, especially discoveries of like fine tuning and modern cosmology and Big Bang theory. And they think that these are, you know, indicators of the supernatural. And I think that there's, you know, there's some interesting arguments to be made there. But for me, the best arguments for the existence of God are metaphysical. They're properly philosophical.
That's
right?
Right.
So really the only thing the theist has to be concerned about, is there anything within the sort of, within what we know of the best of contemporary science that should cause me to absolutely think that God does not exist, or should evidence against belief in God? And there, I think the answer is very easily no. There's nothing whatsoever. You know, sometimes people think about evolutionary theory. Evolutionary theory is not a problem, not at all, with a theistic worldview.
Mm-hmm.
It only becomes a problem when you're sort of like hardcore reductive Darwinian, where you think that it's just, everything reduces to atomic and evolutionary theory. When you think that these sorts of explanations, while very plausibly partial explanations, or exhaustive explanations, that's the only thing that I deny, and I think everybody should deny. I think there's good reason to deny it, even if you're not a theist, that you should deny that science is by any means exhaustive. It just simply isn't. It's a powerful tool, but it's a limited tool.
Yep, absolutely. And on the flip side, too, we also want to make sure that our worldview on the theistic perspective is not so reductionistic in and of itself that it doesn't allow for the exploration of... So, for example, like you were mentioning earlier, evolution isn't incongruent with divine revelation in a theistic philosophy. However, if you are completely reductionistic to only want to hold to a creationist worldview that doesn't allow for the exploration of anything modern science has to offer, then you're going to hit an impasse at some point.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And there's certainly, it's important to differentiate these things, right? We're here kind of considering classical theism or a broadly theistic and Thomistic worldview, which of course is certainly compatible with Catholicism. But if other people have more specific or restricted religious commitments, you mentioned the, you know, sort of the fundamentalist creationism, well, then they're going to have to deal with that themselves, because I'm not in that camp, right?
well, that's a very succinct way to put it, but yeah, you're completely right. So
then you are going to be at odds, right, with a lot of contemporary science, and then you're going to have to try and find a way to resolve that for yourself, right? But that's not a problem that we have.
Certainly not as
classical theists, and not even as Catholics, right? The church does not dogmatically commit you to that position, so there's just no problem there, right?
Right, absolutely. Like I enjoy mentioning, very few people, or I want to say more and more people are realizing this, but Georges Lemaître, he was a Belgian-French Catholic priest, and he gave Einstein the equations for what eventually became general relativity, but he's the founder of what we now know as the Big Bang Theory,
the
Great Expansion. So, no, the Catholic Church has never been at odds with the discovery of the natural sciences.
And if my memory is right, he actually had to pump the brakes for the Pope getting too excited about it being an indicator of course, the creation event. So he was very modest, but that's right. He was a significant contributor to modern Big Bang cosmology. That's correct, yeah.
So
I'm sorry, your other question was, you know, why, you know, science? What worldview does it sit better with? Well, if you're a theist, right, you know, at sort of bottom, at the sort of basement of reality, you maintain a principle of perfection. God is purely actual, the supreme being. Right, that's how traditional theists have always thought about God, who sort of creates out of a principle of goodness and self-diffusion, creates a great hierarchy of being. So you would expect a world that is not just orderly and stable, but intelligible, a world that could be investigated, right?
Right.
It's just the sort of world where we would expect science to be fruitful, because it's a world that is created by the most supreme being imaginable, right? It is a world with a rational structure. This is just the sort of thing that you would expect. Right?
Yeah.
Where you would expect the scientific enterprise to be as fruitful as it is. That just seems profoundly obvious to me. It's hardly even worth stating. But what is not so obvious is why we would encounter that experience, call it the fruitfulness of science, within a naturalistic worldview, where the world is run by a principle of utter indifference. Whatever else naturalists want to say their sort of bottom level entity or collection of entities may be, they are committed to the idea that it's indifferent, right? It's not any sort of supreme being. It's not a being that's sort of intentionally ordering creation towards anything. It's just utterly indifferent, right? This is the principle of indifference.
Yep.
Now, if that's the case, and you think that there's even a sort of realm that, you know, sort of proceeds from that could be investigated, there's no reason to think just from that you would get beings that are capable of staging such an investigation, right?
Right.
Beings like us that are conscious, rational agents that can reflect upon experience and develop these incredibly powerful tools of empirical investigation and be fruitful with them. There's nothing about a naturalistic worldview that would ever cause you to expect that. And in fact, most naturalists will happily concede that it seems to be quite a fantastic miracle.
Yep, exactly.
That has even happened at all. So when you think about this just very broadly, I think it's almost painfully obvious that the sort of success of science is the sort of thing you would expect if God exists. It's not really the sort of thing you would expect to occur at all if naturalism is true. Maybe they can tell some story about it, but if some sort of phenomena is better anticipated on one hypothesis than another, then it counts as evidential confirmation of that former hypothesis to some degree, right?
Right.
So I think the theist can make a claim there.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. And like you mentioned earlier, that the strongest arguments we have for the basis of our faith and the quote-unquote God of the philosophers, as you've engaged, are arguments by way of philosophical fittingness, which then brings to the fore and this bigger question, which is, we're living now in a post-quote-unquote enlightenment, right? In a post
Enlightenment worldview wherein the empirical has been elevated to be the ontological, or at least it's in the place of what used to be the place of the ontological. And so anything with regard to theology, philosophy, reason, the liberal arts, all of these things have been relegated to as if they're second-class sciences, which is you know, really flipping the thing on the head, the sciences on the head, because in reality, the empirical are actually the lower sciences. The hard sciences are the lower sciences. And when put in right order, they serve to greater illuminate the things that reason and divine revelation tell us about God and reality.
Yeah, obviously I agree with that, right? You know, first philosophy is metaphysics, as Aristotle tells us, right? Mm-hmm. So again, this is not to denigrate or deny the obvious enormous power and success of the hard sciences, especially physics. But the theist should be somebody who kind of sees it all in this great sort of ordering or hierarchy, right?
Yep.
And to see, right, that, you know, if you really want to build an entire system, one that makes sense of not just the etiological, just to bring back the phrase that you used before, mm-hmm. but also the qualitative, right? Our conscious experience, moral experience, you know, the what it is likeness to be a human being, which, of course, it's through the qualitative that we get any of the quantitative to begin with.
That's right.
So that's right. Yeah, I agree. I think that the sort of reductive empiricist has it completely backwards. That's not just the modern issue, right? And none of these things, you know, even though there's sort of specific modern formulations, a lot of these errors are, and I believe they are errors. That's what I'm arguing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have very ancient roots, you know, back to ancient atomism and stuff like that. You've had your reductivists, you know, throughout
right.
all of history, so. Yeah, the debate very broadly is one that's really kind of been going on throughout the entire history of philosophy. It just has its sort of, more modern permutations, if you will.
Right. And the modern permutations have resulted in a lot of, well, frankly, destructive systems, and one of which is the modern naturalism has really paved the way for what we now see as moral relativism and religious pluralism in the public sphere. If only the empirical is to be deemed valid, well, then believe whatever you want, because moral nihilism is the way to go. There is no objective moral system to begin with.
Yes, and that relates back to what we said before. Now, many moral relativists will deny that they're nihilists, but I think that denial is unsustainable. I think once you grant the conditions for relativism, it is a very quick, it's not just a slippery slope, it's a mm-hmm. water slide
right.
to nihilism. Yeah, so I would just want to draw that point out, right? So, you know, relativists, you know, they're kind of in this weird position where they want to say that all of our sort of moral experiences are just relative to something, right? Whether it's just evolutionary pressures or certain cultures or whatever, right? But it's, they're not, you know, universally binding upon all human beings.
Yep.
But then they typically don't just, you know, go to nihilism right away and just say, ah, well, whatever then. Many of them actually go on to make universally binding moral claims,
mm-hmm.
like you ought not to judge other cultures, right? Or you ought not to impose your values on other people, right? So
right. They're
taking back their relativism with, you know, the other hand, if you will. So always got to be on the lookout for those sort of, you know, internal performance contradictions. But again, I think that the relativist who tries to be consistent will wind up in nihilism, or if they're going to try and push these moral claims, they're going to have to backtrack and abandon relativism. I think relativism is an inherently and obviously unstable middle ground. It just
mm-hmm.
doesn't work. Right?
Yep, absolutely. And of course, if one had sound first principles, even the first law of logic itself would refute relativism. So we're back to square one where we began this conversation. So for all the listeners right now, if they want to kind of set on the path of setting about developing a right framework, a right system, epistemological system of a worldview, a philosophy, how can they begin, aside from reading your brilliant book, The Best Argument for God?
Well, thank you again. It's just really very kind of you to recommend it. You know, I am somebody who believes in having a broad classical education. So I think that you should read all the great works of philosophy. But let me give another book recommendation. There's a wonderful book from a philosopher who himself was agnostic for many years and became Catholic very late into his life, when he was 90s. His name's Mortimer Adler.
Mm-hmm.
He has lots of wonderful works out in philosophy, but one book I would recommend to everybody is How to Read a Book. And this actually is a book in classical logic. You won't realize it at first, but it is a book really in Aristotelian logic, but it will help you to get the most out of your reading. But at the back of that book, if you go right to the back of the book, he has his great books collection. And this is what I think everybody should make their personal reading list. And of course, you'll find the works of Thomas Aquinas in there, but you also find the works of Nietzsche, because it is very important
right.
that you read people who disagree with you, that you see what the opposition is up to. Ultimately, I believe this will serve to strengthen you once you see the force and the intellectual muscle that the Catholic tradition has against mm-hmm. these opposing viewpoints. So I often recommend people get started there. You read Adler's book, and you just go to the back, and you just start working your way through those great books. It doesn't matter what level you're at. You know, just do as much as you can. You know, this is really, I think, just so necessary in today's society, where unfortunately so much of a proper philosophical education has been completely lost.
Yeah. Yeah, and taken for granted. Lost is one thing, right? But also, when it rears its head, when philosophy shows itself, it's completely taken for granted, because, you know, as we've mentioned earlier, in light of this over-aggrandizing view of the empirical, philosophy is deemed as this science to be poo-pooed, to be completely shunned, because it has no place in the public sphere.
Right, and of course that's going to require some philosophical argumentation.
That's right.
And that's always the great irony, right? Especially with scientism, is the idea that we can only know what comes through the scientific method is not something that can come through the scientific
that's
method.
That's right.
So you can't, you know, there's a saying, like, you can't escape philosophy. You can only escape doing it well. Since we're stuck with it, we might as well work pretty hard at it, right? I think that's probably a good way to live.
Right? Well, that was a brilliant way to end, Pat. Been talking to Pat Flynn, author of The Best Argument for God, his most recent book published by Sophia Institute Press. Please pick up a copy of it. Writer, philosopher, podcaster, and speaker living in Wisconsin with his bride, 5 children, and a St. Bernard. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon.